This is the Medicast, February 26th, 2007.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast episode 55. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I want to thank all of you for checking out the show. For all of you brand new listeners, welcome to the Medicast. I am amazed at the stats and numbers I see every week. There's a lot of new listeners coming on board. So I want to welcome you to the Medicast. Check out the podcast. Check out the website at www.medicast.com. Over there, you'll see the blog posts of the things I put up during the week, as well as the show notes for all of the podcasts under the podcast category there. So you can check out all of that information, check out some of the back shows, and welcome. And of course, for all of you long-term listeners and contributors, I want to thank you for everything that you've done. The questions, the comments, the corrections you've sent in are all greatly appreciated. I have some great things coming up planned for the next month as we end up the month of February here and move into March. On the Tuesday, March 6th, I will be doing a live Medicast podcast on TalkShoe.com. It's a free service, so you can head on over to TalkShoe.com and you'll find information there on how you can register yourself. There is a free software you download to enable you to participate in the live podcast, and I'll have one scheduled there. You'll be able to find that shortly. What I plan on doing is maybe once a month, once every other month, getting on there and getting an expert together and talking about an issue that is important to us in EMS. So if you have a topic that's important to you or a topic that you educate on and would like to sit and talk with other EMS providers from around the country and around the world about it, you can do that over at TalkShoe.com on the Medicast live program there. So check that out and get set up for that. I'm excited about it. It's going to take place at 10 p.m. Eastern time. That way, I think it's not too late for those of you that have to work on Wednesday morning, and not so early that those of you that have to work day shift can't get home and get a chance to listen to it. You can actually listen to it live streaming on your computer without participating, but there's an opportunity there. If you take a look at the website, you can actually chat or call in live by phone. If you have a voice over IP service like Skype, you can use that to call in for free or for very inexpensively. Or if you have a cell phone plan that allows you to call free nights and weekends, you have an opportunity to use that too to call in. It's not an 800 number call-in line, but it is a call-in service. And then once you're called in, you can basically click a button to have a chance to talk, and I recognize you, and you get to share your questions and comments with other listeners and hear their feedback as well. So we're going to try it out. We're going to talk about kind of a mishmash or a hodgepodge of subjects on that first episode just to kind of feel out how the process works. It's the first time I'll be hosting one of these as well over there, so it's a learning experience for me. But then I'll put that information up, and that'll be the podcast that week. So if you miss it, you can still get the chance to hear what everyone was talking about on the Medicast podcast for that week. Okay, we're going to jump right on into things. I got some great comments and information this week from several listeners. First of all, I heard from listener Manny. He won the Medicast baseball cap a couple weeks ago, and he is just getting ready to get his information on his EMTB practical and written information. So we're waiting to hear back from that. Manny, good luck to you. I hope that works out for you. I have some information. Several people have asked for information on how to go over the National Registry practical exam and for EMTBs and ALS. And I've done a couple of those in the past. So later in the podcast for the tip this week, I'm going to cover some of that. I also got a comment on the website on last week's podcast show notes, and you can check this out, from listener Amelia down in Australia. And she's an Aussie and a paramedic student, she says, and has just about one more year to go, and was commenting on the Simman simulators that she uses that are provided by Laerdal down in her university. And she just loves it. She says they're great. You can set up via remote control, blood pressure, EKG, heart rate, respiratory rate. You can simulate anaphylaxis, cannulation, vomiting, breath sounds, heart sounds, pain, all kinds of things. Amelia, thank you very much for checking in with your comment and sharing your thoughts with us. And I have quite a few listeners down in Australia, so I appreciate it. You're the first one to email in. So Amelia, thank you very much, and continue listening to the show. I look forward to hearing some more comments for you from you in the future. And share with us your experiences of the paramedic program down in Australia. We'd love to hear what goes on down there. So thank you very much. Well, my focus here every week is on education. Education for myself. That's one of the reasons I started this podcast. Education for all of you out there. And I have just become amazed with all of the great resources that are available out there right now. One of them I've talked about in the past is Rick Rosati's Mitigation Journal podcast. Rick does a fabulous job in his podcast of covering a lot of disaster-related items relating to EMTs, EMS, paramedics, as well as fire services and other broader emergency services applications. This past week, he had a separate in-service podcast. He does about a 45-minute podcast weekly on Monday mornings that comes out. And also, this week, he put out an extra episode that covers acid-base balance. Those of you who've been paramedics for a while, you remember acid-base balance. You pulled your hair out till you finally internalized it enough to understand what was going on. It's one of those things that once you figure it out, it's really not that hard, but it just takes a while to get your brain wrapped around it. At least it did for me. Rick does a really good job using some good analogies and great information on describing the acid-base balance system, how it works, different types of acidosis and alkalosis, and he covers it all over there at the Mitigation Journal podcast. So I've got a link to this specific podcast in the show notes, the entry on his site over there, as well as a link to his main site page. Check out the Mitigation Journal podcast with Rick Rosati. It's just an excellent resource for anybody in EMS or firefighting or interested in disaster preparedness at the agency level. Let's just jump right on into the news. I found a story over based in Fresno, California, at the Kings and Tulare County District of the Order of the Eastern Star, and this is a Masonic fraternal group. They are holding an event for the first time to honor EMS rescue teams and other workers who are not often recognized as much as local law enforcement officers and firefighters. They're going to be holding the event to honor groups like the Sierra Search Dogs, the Sequoia Mountain Rescue Service, Kings County Sheriff's Department Search and Rescue and Water Rescue, as well as AMR Ambulance, Imperial Ambulance, and Golden State Air Evacuation Units, as well as paramedics from the Lemoore Naval Air Station. And this is just a great program. You know, often we have programs ourselves during EMS Week, or if you're part of a fire service, Fire Prevention Week. But it's nice to see an organization in the community coming forward and recognizing our groups, and kind of, it's not us blowing our own horn. It's somebody else that's out there that recognizes us. It always feels good to get a thank you from the community or a thank you from a patient. And I think this is a great plan and a program, and I'm excited to see and thankful that an organization in that area has recognized the rescue workers and emergency services, EMS workers in that community. So kudos to you at the Fraternal Order of the Eastern Star in Kings and Tulare County, California. Speaking of gathering together, how often do you get together with other providers that aren't necessarily part of your service in order to share knowledge and share information and network? Well, there's lots of organizations at the state and county level that hold events all over this country all the time. And I really urge you to get out to them. You know, there's the main national conventions. There's the EMS Responder Convention that's out in Las Vegas. There's the GEMS Conference coming up in Baltimore soon in a few weeks, which I will be there late Friday afternoon. So I'll try to catch up with anybody that can find me there on the expo floor. I'll be wandering around looking at everything. And but when do you get together locally in your community to like meet some agency personnel from neighboring organizations or mutual aid companies? There's a nice article that talks about a Southern Idaho Fire Academy event that's held. This is the 13th annual one that was held just recently. And it talks about hundreds of firefighters, EMTs, and other responders coming together from all over Southern Idaho to meet and have classes where they do exercises ranging from electrical safety and equipment upkeep, car extrication, even live burn demonstrations. And all of these things happen when agencies put together opportunities for us to gather together and share knowledge. So if there's not something that's going on like this in your community, maybe this is an opportunity for you to put one together. Maybe you're in an area that's a little more isolated and it's hard to get together. But, you know, once a year, if you can even pull 25 or 30 people together from neighboring agencies and sit down and have a roundtable discussion, have everybody spend a little money to put into the program, maybe from their training budgets, hire a professional facilitator, maybe from a local university, and sit around and have a roundtable discussion about certain issues that have been cropping up lately in your agency or neighboring agencies. Maybe this is a great way to problem solve. Also, you can bring in outside trainers to come in, do a big event where you have somebody like Billy Goldfeder or some other major speaker come in and talk to your organization during an all-day event, maybe a dinner that you host at your fire hall, and give an opportunity to share knowledge and camaraderie and network with each other. This is a way for us all to get a little better at what we do. It's funny, all the little tips and tricks that we come across. And if you don't talk to each other, you won't realize that, you know, somebody else does something a little different, and that might work better for me in some situations. That's the way we find out things. I think that's why a lot of you listen to shows like the Medicast, because you like to find out what other people are doing and maybe find ways to become better providers yourselves. And this is just another way to do it. I talk every week about scene safety and BSI at the very end of each podcast, and that's because I want you all to be aware of these things. It needs to be a way for us to kind of stay focused on that and make sure that we come home every night to our loved ones safely. And if you haven't read it recently, there's a great post over at the medicscribe.blogspot.com blog. Peter Canning wrote something about, do we understand that we work in a dangerous profession, an inherently dangerous profession, or do we just work in it and accept that someday we're going to get hurt? You know, there's a difference between understanding we have a dangerous profession and working to make sure we're safe and accepting that we're going to get hurt someday. And I agree with his assessment, but on that, you can head over and read that over there. But I found a story this week that talks about these kind of things, and especially the unexpected things that happen to us. I think this happened in Cincinnati, Ohio area. A pregnant woman was being transported down a staircase by three emergency medical technicians when the staircase collapsed under them, and they all four fell 15 feet to the ground. They were transporting her from her second floor apartment down some wooden stairs when they collapsed. All three of the EMTs fell over on top of the patient and caused some neck and back injuries to her. Plus, she was having contractions and in labor at the time. She did safely give birth to a healthy baby boy at the hospital, and all three were treated and released from the hospital for their injuries. But, you know, we worry about, you know, stabbings and gunshot wounds and dogs and all the other things that may be out there to cause dangerous situations to us And we need to be more aware of some other things too. And this includes how to get up and down the stairs safely. Those stairs have probably taken people up and down for years. And when it's one or two people at a time, it's fine. But when you put three providers plus the patient plus a stretcher or a stair chair on it, and you're just overloading the system. So be aware of how you're going to get in and out of a house and how to do it safely. In this situation, maybe the patient could have been walked down the stairs, and I'm not second-guessing them because who knew this was going to collapse. But be aware of these things. If the stairs don't look all that safe, maybe there's another way out of the building. Maybe there's something else you can do to be more prepared for this kind of thing. Again, I think these guys, there's no indication anybody did anything wrong. It's just a quirky, odd thing that just is one more thing you want to keep in the back of your mind. While we're working in the state of Ohio, let's stay there. I found a story on emsresponder.com that talks about a new software computer program that's going to be available for certain dispatch and fire agencies there that's going to allow them to have detailed 3D images of their dispatch areas, basically a 3D topographical map that will allow them to do all kinds of things like accurately measure distances, locate things like hydrant access or other routes around traffic congestion, other things like that. All of it, especially for things like natural disasters, it will allow people to get damage assessment information by looking at satellite photographs that show before and after pictures in real time, I think. So this is pretty cool. And it brings to mind how we need to kind of keep our eyes open and find out what other kinds of services and things are out there for us and for our communities. Sometimes you can find out exactly how other companies are doing things in other business areas, not even in EMS or medically related services. Maybe somebody else is using a particular kind of tracking software for a delivery company, and you can apply that same technology to keep track of your units in the field on the EMS side and maybe better able to dispatch. And this is kind of a management issue, but you know, I like to think that all of us are going to be managers someday, that we're all going to become, you know, the leaders in our community. You're taking the time to listen to shows like the Medicast, like Rick Rosati's Mitigation Journal. You're out there checking out websites and blogs on EMS, and that means you are a leader. You're taking the initiative to become informed. So I believe I am talking to the leaders. So keep your eyes open, Alan. How you're going to, maybe if you were running the agency, what you would do in the future. It's something to think about. So check out this story in the show notes. It's pretty cool. Finally, I found a story on a study that looks at the process by which our own internal clocks monitor and modify our body's processes during the day, specifically on how it relates to the upswing of heart attacks and strokes that we in the field see happening in the mornings usually. We do have a larger number of heart attacks and strokes at certain times of the day, and it's long been speculated that this is a result of an internal body clock that regulates the cyclic nature of our body's systems. But the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine has provided evidence that the body's internal molecular clock is actually controlling our blood pressure and the mechanism by which this occurs. And what they've done is they've found that this gene process in the brain that controls our circadian rhythms, our 24-hour body clock, there's a concurrent rise in blood pressure at the same time every day. Our master clock, based upon when we rise in the morning, raises our blood pressure to get us up in the morning, to help us get moving after we've been sleeping all night. So if you have a high blood pressure anyway, and now your clock is raising your blood pressure a little bit in the morning to help you get moving, and then you have additional stresses put on you on top of it, like at work or getting ready for work, or you lost your car keys, or you have to shovel your car out, and suddenly boom, you're in the middle of a heart attack. What these researchers found was that by regulating this or cutting off this gene's control of your catecholamine release, your norepinephrine and epinephrine release, which is what this thing does to regulate your blood pressure, that they were able to actually cut off this clock's regulation of this particular part of the body's rhythm cycle. Now, it's not something we want to do all day long, and it's dangerous to mess with these type of things, as evidenced by anybody that you've needed to actually stimulate their fight or flight response by giving them catecholamines and they're on beta blockers. You know that you have a diminished response because the beta blockers are cutting off what you're trying to get to. So what we would like to do, though, and what researchers are trying to find out is, if you gave a targeted medication that maybe suppressed this rhythm so that the dosage was going to take effect early in the morning and it acted throughout the morning until it dissipated on its own, you could regulate this early morning danger for high blood pressure patients, for patients that are at an increased risk for a heart attack or stroke. So this is just something to be aware of on the front out there and understand a little bit about how the body's systems are working. You may have a patient that's experiencing an MI or having a stroke early in the morning, and you can understand that their catecholamine system is running a little higher than usual, that it might be causing this problem because of their internal clock. In keeping with the idea of dealing with heart attacks and strokes and other serious medical problems, I thought I would jump right into the tip and trick of the week this week. I have done this in the past where I've covered the National Registry skill sheets, the ones that you use to test out on. And these are readily available. You can head over to the National Registry site at nremt.org. And if you go to the site for exam coordinators, you can actually download the skill sheets, the blank skill sheets. There's nothing secret about them. They just tell you exactly what the preceptor that's running your program is looking for. And so when you sit in on that skill station, you're going to be prepared a little bit better to make sure that they don't miss something that you know they need to check off. Okay? Doesn't mean you're cheating. It just means, you know, instead of just doing something, you want to make sure you verbalize these things. I also think it's important to review these skill sheets and do something that athletes do, and that's visualization. I don't know if any of you are athletes or have been organized athletics participants in the past, but visualization is an important thing to do for any physical activity or mental activity. It gives your brain a chance to rehearse what you're going to do. And you really just sit down and you close your eyes and you run through the process from start to finish over and over again so that your brain knows what to do. And this is what we do when we study for things, but it's a little bit more than that. It's more directed visualization. I'm now going to pick this up. I pick that up and then I do this with it. I'm going to check this blood pressure. I'm going to do this skill. You do all these things because this is a physical program when you do your skill sheets, and it'll just be one more thing to help you get through the test and help with your anxiety about the test a little bit. The National Registry practical tests, and I'm sure the practical tests in other countries around the world, are all based to find out and make sure that you know a basic skill set before you get out into the street. It's not there to tell you that this is the only way to do something, but it is there to tell you that this is the best way to do something as this program understands it. And there's no substitute for actually doing the hands-on practice. This isn't going to get you through it if you don't know how to use a bag valve mask. You can visualize using a bag valve mask all day long. If you've never used one before, you're going to look like an idiot when you get your hands on it. So you still need to do the physical practice. But when you've done the physical practice, visualizing can really help you move forward and alleviate some of your stress and tension because you're going to feel more prepared when you get into the situation. So this week, I'm looking at two different skills. They're related, and they may even be combined into one skill station when you get into your test situation. And they are the airway oxygen and ventilation skills, upper airway adjuncts and suction, and the bag valve mask for an apneic patient. And both of these skill stations are things that you need to know, and it's something that National Registry tests you on. As always, you can check back in the show notes for other podcasts. I've covered just some general tips on taking practical tests, as well as some other skill stations that are out there, and I plan on covering more of these in the future. So without further ado, let's jump right on into this. When you walk into the room, you're going to be asked to check your equipment. Go ahead and take a few moments to do that. You're going to have some airway devices, oropharyngeal, nasopharyngeal airways, as well as a suction device. You want to check them out, make sure they're working properly, make sure that the ones that you're familiar with are there. And if it's not a device you're familiar with, if it's a product like a suction device that you're not familiar with, you want to ask the instructor if you're allowed to have some quick instruction on how to use it. They may say no, but if it's something that's really that alien to you, then they'll probably go ahead and let you have a few more moments to do that. Here's what you're going to do. You're going to go ahead and, first of all, scene safety, BSI. Remember, my number one tip for this is to wear gloves at the beginning of the day and don't take them off till you're done your tests completely. Take and verbalize body substance isolation precautions. You're going to go up to the mannequin or the airway head. You're going to measure and select the appropriately sized oropharyngeal airway. You're going to measure it from the corner of the mouth to the tip of the earlobe. You're then going to insert the airway in such a way as not to push the tongue posteriorly. You may use a tongue blade to do this. You may also put in the oropharyngeal device upside down and then advance it to the back, twisting it so that it turns over and rests at the base of the tongue. The examiner will then advise the candidate that the patient is gagging and becoming conscious. When this is announced to you, you will remove the oropharyngeal airway. The examiner will now advise you that you must suction the patient's airway. You will turn on and prepare your suction device. You will assure the presence of the mechanical suction. In other words, you'll make sure it's working. And then you'll insert the suction tip without suction and then apply suction on the way out of the oronasopharynx. Okay? This means you're going to appropriately visualize and you're not going to advance it beyond the point where you can see it. And you're not going to start suction until you're on the way out of the oropharynx. In other words, you don't suction on the way in, you suction on the way out. This avoids causing trauma to the tissues. Now you'll be advised that you need to insert a nasopharyngeal airway. Again, you'll select the appropriately sized airway. Here, you can verbalize that you might measure that by comparing it to the size of the pinky of the patient. You will also measure the length of the airway by measuring from the nares to the earlobe. You will then verbalize that you're lubricating the nasal airway because a lot of people don't want you to gunk up their mannequins. And you'll fully insert the airway with the bevel facing toward the septum. Once you've done all this, you will then be finished the station. Some critical criteria, in other words, automatic fail points. If you don't take or verbalize BSI precautions, you automatically fail. So that's why I say wear your gloves when you walk into the room. It might save you from this one. I still advise you saying scene safety BSI, but if you wear your gloves, they might give you the benefit of the doubt. If you don't obtain a patent airway with the oropharyngeal airway, in other words, if you push the tongue back because you didn't insert it properly, if you don't get the nasopharyngeal airway inserted properly, again, you could fail. If you don't demonstrate acceptable suction technique, and if you insert any of the adjuncts in a manner that is dangerous to the patient, all of these are critical fail points. And that is the airway oxygen and ventilation skills, upper airway adjuncts, and suction station. The next station I'll cover is the bag valve mask for the apneic patient. Again, You're going to want to make sure that you get an opportunity to check out the equipment, make sure that it's all in working order and that you're familiar with it. This will be an opportunity for you to look and see, because you're going to have to insert an airway adjunct again. This is where you're going to have to look and see what oropharyngeal and nasopharyngeal airways are there on the table. They should have enough of both to use either or. You can select whichever one you're most comfortable with in this station. You're also going to have an oxygen tank, or will need to verbalize that you have an oxygen tank and are prepared to hook it up. There is nothing wrong with quickly hooking up to the oxygen tank or verbalizing that you're directing a partner to hook up to the oxygen tank while you're bagging the patient. And this will, if you do this before you ventilate the patient, it's okay as long as you've ventilated them rapidly enough without taking too much extra time. You're going to take and verbalize body substance isolation again. Wear your gloves, and you might avoid this problem, but always verbalize scene safety BSI. You're going to verbalize that you're opening the airway with a head tilt, chin lift, or if there's trauma suspected, you would verbalize you're using a modified jaw thrust maneuver. You will verbalize inserting an airway adjunct. You will then select the properly sized bag valve mask. This is going to be an adult patient most likely, but you want to make sure that you're using an adult sized mask. They might try to have a couple of PD masks laying around, so that you want to make sure you have the right mask attached to the bag valve mask. You're going to create a proper mask to face seal using the EC hand position, where you're actually pressing down and getting a good seal with the mask. And then you will ventilate the patient at the proper rate and adequate volume for at least 30 seconds. So the examiner will tell you that you're finished doing this, or you've done enough, and they'll tell you to move on. You'll want to make sure that you connect reservoir and oxygen, and you'll want to adjust the flow rate to 15 liters per minute or greater. Now, again, if you do this, the instant you grab the bag valve mask, you hook it up and turn your oxygen on and then start bagging, then this step will have already happened. The examiner will indicate the arrival of a second EMT, and the second EMT will be instructed to ventilate the patient while the candidate controls the mask in the airway. And again, this is the two-person bag valve mask procedure. One of you will hold the mask in a double EC position, holding the airway open, and the other will operate the bag and properly bag the patient. How much ventilation do you provide to any patient? Just enough for the chest to rise, not more and not less. You don't need to squeeze that whole bag closed, just enough to get the chest to rise. If you have a half mannequin or you can visualize the lungs, you can just enough to expand the lungs or expand the chest just a little bit. Once your imaginary second provider arrives, you're going to vocalize reopening the airway using two hands. You're going to create a proper mask-to-face seal, and then you're going to instruct your assistant, who will probably be the preceptor acting as the second EMT, to resume ventilation at a proper rate and adequate volume, as you've been instructed in your classes. Usually this is between 12 and 20 breaths per minute, depending on what your service is using for that. Again, slow and steady wins the race. Ventilate your patients at 100% oxygen at a rate of about a breath every 5 seconds will be just fine for most preceptors out there. Again, critical fail points. If you don't take your body substance isolation precautions, if you don't immediately ventilate your patient, and by immediately, within 20 seconds of the start of the scenario. So this is why I say, if you are checking out your equipment and you lay everything out carefully as you're checking it out, you pick up your bag valve mask, squeeze it, make sure it's right, make sure the mask is the correct size, have your oxygen tubing attached and ready to go. You can't attach it to the tank, but what you can do is lay your tubing out so it's just there next to the bag valve mask near the tank. And then when you go to start, go ahead and hook it up, turn your tank on, and start bagging the patient after you open the airway. And guess what? In like 5 seconds, you've accomplished most of the scenario requirements right there. If you fail to ventilate the patient for more than 20 seconds or fail to provide high concentration oxygen at 15 liters or greater, that's a fail point. If you don't provide the correct ventilation ratio or don't instruct your assistant to provide the correct ventilation ratio or don't allow for adequate exhalation, which is, of course, a side effect of having the wrong ventilation ratio, all of these are fail points. So those are the check sheets, the National Registry checkoff sheets for the bag valve mask for the apneic patient and the airway oxygen skills for upper airway adjuncts and suction. You can check out a link to these downloads in the show notes at medicast.com for this episode. And you can also head on over to National Registry website at nremt.org for all of the check sheets to download, both for BLS and ALS patients. You'll find them all there. Moving into this week's Med of the Week, it must be National Calcium Channel Blocker Month or something. I just got done doing last week's episode, getting everything loaded up and uploaded for last week's episode, where the Med of the Week was diltiazem or Cardizem, the calcium channel blocker for AFib patients. And lo and behold, I get an email, and I'm checking my email, from our county's training representative, and the Maryland state protocol has changed because of a discontinued production of the Cardizem powdered form where you actually reconstitute it in the field. They are now providing only the refrigerated liquid version, which, of course, we don't have refrigerators on all of our ambulances and can no longer provide Cardizem for our patients if we are going to have it expire every 30 days. So in the powdered form, it was good for better than a year. And so this was something that was of concern, obviously, to our medical director at the state level here in Maryland. And they made a decision to go ahead and institute a new calcium channel blocker to work with AFib patients, and that is Verapamil. So, as I've said in the past, the Medicast is as much a learning experience for me as it is for you. It helps me study for the things I need to study up on, and I'm going to go ahead and do Verapamil this week for the Med of the Week. So, let's look a little bit about Verapamil. Some of the things that you need to be concerned about, and the reason that we didn't use Verapamil before this, is because there are some increased dangers for hypotension, a higher risk for onset of hypotension as a result of administering this drug than there was for using Cardizem. So Cardizem was a little bit safer, had a better risk-benefit ratio. But since we're using Verapamil, we need to be constantly aware of that. Pharmacology is Verapamil, as I've said, is a calcium channel blocker. And basically, it inhibits the movement of calcium ions across cardiac muscle cells and therefore decreases the conduction velocity and the ventricular rate. So when you have a patient with AFib or A-flutter and they have a rapid ventricular response, this is going to slow that response down and help them have a heart rate that is going to be more under control. You are going to be using this for narrow complex symptomatic AFib or A-flutter. So again, symptomatic. They may have AFib or A-flutter and they may have a tachycardia, but they're not having chest pains. They're not diaphoretic. They're not showing any signs of decreased perfusion or are being hemodynamically unstable. Then you're not going to give this medication. Contraindications, hypotension below 90 millimeters of mercury, second or third degree heart blocks, and hypersensitivity to the drug. If you have a patient with a history of Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome, you're not going to want to give this medication, as well as patients in ventricular tachycardia or patients less than 18 years of age. Adverse effects you may see. I already spoke a little bit about an increased rate of hypotension seen in patients that take Verapamil, as well as bradycardia, vomiting, nausea, and headache. We want to use special caution when using this drug for patients that have a history of renal failure or congestive heart failure or are taking beta blockers. And you know, how many cardiac patients do you know that aren't taking beta blockers? So again, you really need to get a good history and get a list of their meds before you go ahead and give this medication. The dosage for adults is going to be 2.5 to 10 milligrams slow IV push over 2 minutes. And if the response is not adequate at that point, you're going to want to repeat in 15 minutes with an additional dose of 2.5 to 10 milligrams again after you've gotten medical consultation. In Maryland, which is where I'm getting this information from, for the Maryland protocol, medical consultation is required for using verapamil, just as it was for administering diltiazem. It's also important to remember, congestive heart failure may result or be exacerbated if this is used along with beta blockers. So it's really important that you're aware of that. Now, you may see overdose or toxicity presentation. Maybe you're giving verapamil and the patient's already on verapamil and you weren't aware of it. You generally will see exaggeration of the side effects, including a severe hypotension and symptomatic bradycardia response. How do we treat overdoses of this particular medication? Well, you want to go ahead and use your protocol to give supportive care, monitor your vitals, administer oxygen. You want to have a 250 milligram loading dose of calcium chloride, slow IV push with medical consult, and start an IV fluid challenge of either normal saline or lactated ringers, depending on your protocol requirements. And we can also use a Trendelenburg position, elevate the legs to increase blood pressure temporarily. All of these things are things that you can do to up front. So you need a medical order for giving calcium chloride. I would go ahead and ask for that when you consult to give the verapamil or the diltiazem for that matter. Go ahead and consult and say, hey, I want to give this much of the calcium channel blocker. I'd also like permission to have 250 milligrams of calcium chloride on hand in case of symptomatic hypotension as a result of administering the calcium channel blocker. I've never had a problem with a doctor telling me, don't do that. They've gone ahead and given that standing order so that if I have the problem, I don't have to call back and go through the process of recontacting them. Also, if you have a symptomatic bradycardia present, you're going to want to either consider transcutaneous pacing or consider giving 0.5 to 1 milligrams of atropine, whatever, again, is allowed in your protocol. So that's verapamil. It's a new med for me. It may not be a new med for you, but I thought I would cover it since it's something I had to learn this week. And again, the Medicast teaches me as much as it teaches you. And that's going to wrap up this episode of the Medicast. As always, you can check out all the links to everything I've talked about here over at the website at www.medicast.com. Everything is over there, the show notes for this and all the other episodes, plus a lot of other information. I put up probably 4 or 5 other posts during the week on the site that is other information that you may find interesting and important. So check out the Medicast site often throughout the week so that you can get all of the information that you need to have to be the best EMS providers you can be. Another way to do that is to sign up for the free Medicast newsletter email. And by signing up for the email newsletter, you get a list of the show notes information every week sent to you when I publish a new episode of the podcast, plus an additional newsletter once a month with extra tips and tricks just for newsletter subscribers. So head on over to the website. There's a link in the show notes as well on the main page for free Medicast newsletter in the upper right-hand corner. Sign up there, fill out a few quick things of information. And for everybody that is a current newsletter subscriber, make sure that when you get your newsletter that you're going to get an email in your mailbox that is going to have a link in it that you're going to have to click to verify that you are who you say you are. This way, you're not getting spammed by anybody, and I don't get spam signing up for my email newsletter, which happens, believe me. So you can go ahead and make sure you click that link. I've enabled a new part of that service that you're going to have to click that link or you'll be unsubscribed. So when you get that email, you want to make sure that you click the link in there and that'll verify that you actually signed up. Okay. And that's a great way for you to stay informed about things as well. I will wrap up now, as I always do, with some great PodSafe music. This week, it's a song by a band called Jim's Big Ego. And, you know, as we all move into the springtime season and start doing spring cleaning and try to get out of the wintertime blahs here in the Northern Hemisphere, I thought it would be appropriate for us to have a song called Stress. So you can check out a link to Jim's Big Ego's site in the show notes, as well as a direct link to the iTunes store where you can actually purchase and download this song for yourself. It's a great tune, a little bit of tongue-in-cheek, but I think it's appropriate for all of us. So until next time, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Scene safety, BSI.
Stress, that's the way that I get things done. If I'm not under pressure, then I sleep too long and I hang around like a bum. I think I'm going nowhere and that makes me nervous. Everybody's out to get me, but I feel alright. Everybody's out to get me, but I feel alright. Everybody's out to get me, but I feel alright.
Everybody's thinking about me.
It's the little things that get you. It's the little things that get you when you weren't paying attention. It's the little things that get you. It's the little things that get you. It's the little things that get you when you weren't paying attention. Trying to cut down on my caffeine consumption. So when I get up, I just have one cup of coffee, and I like to have another cup of coffee with my breakfast. And on the way to work, I like to get a cup of coffee, like the kind of cup of coffee that you get with the donuts. If I never get the donut, I just have the cup of coffee. And when I get to work, I like to have a cup of coffee, because I like to have a coffee when I'm talking on the phone. It usually goes cold, and I need to get another cup of coffee, and it's lunch, and I have an espresso. It's not morning anymore, so I have a Diet Cola and another Diet Cola. But then I'm feeling fine, and I'm feeling pretty sharp, and I'm feeling pretty wired, and I'm getting things done. But right about 2, I get this little tiny migraine. It starts by my eyes, and it moves to the back of my neck, and it moves to the bottom of my spine. But it doesn't get there till 5 or 6 o'clock, which is the end of the day. So I'm fine, so I'm fine, so I'm fine, so I'm fine, so I'm fine. Except when I have to work late, when I have to work late, which I usually do. Addicted to stress, that's the way that I get things done. If I'm not under pressure, then I sleep too long, and I hang around like a bum, and I think I'm going nowhere, and that makes me nervous. Everybody's at the game, but I feel alright. Everybody's at the game, but I feel alright. Everybody's at the game, but I feel alright. Everybody's thinking about me. Hey, how you doing? Looking good. You been working out? Yeah, I can tell. Alright, see you later. I love to work, I love to roll, I love to play real hard. I love to steal little things from the grocery store, like a piece of bubble gum, or sometimes I just stick my thumb in a peach and leave it there. I love to work, I love to run, I love to water ski, snowboard, jet ski, skydive, parasail, hang glide, rollerblade, mountain bike, bungee jump. Well, I mean, I'd love to do these things if I ever had the time. I love to work, I love to work, I love to work out after work. I love to spend a little time with this one I'm seeing, except we never really get all time to spend together, so we call each other up and we talk about work. But what I think I really love is to get up on myself on a little tiny island in the middle of the ocean with just me and a book and a cellular phone and a personal computer in case something came up. And I'd eat and I'd drink and I'd run and I'd sleep and I wouldn't do nothing except swim all day. So, you know, my beeper doesn't work underwater. Where are the sharks? Where are the sharks? Where are the sharks? And there's this kind of anemone that sticks in your foot and the poison goes up to your brain and you die. And sand, please! Sand, please! Actually, I think it'd be really relaxing. Just me by myself in the middle of the ocean. And that's what I really love to do more than anything else. Except I probably hate it. Addicted to stress, that's the way that I get things done. If I'm not under pressure, then I sleep too long. And I hang around like a bum. I think I'm going nowhere and that makes me nervous. Everybody's